Penguin Random House Audio presents Can You Tolerate This? Essays by Ashley Young. Read for you by Saskia Malleveld. Bones. It stands silently and elegantly and reveals its secrets if you ask the right questions. Dr. Frederick S. Kaplan, orthopedic surgeon. Authority on Fibrodysplasia Ossificans Progressiva, 1998. Harry's first skeleton was the one he was born with. That was the healthy skeleton of a small boy. The only odd thing about this skeleton was that it had a bulbous bony protrusion on the left big toe. Aside from that, it was ordinary. His bones were ordinary bones. They were made of living cells and had marrow inside them, like the bones of fish, birds, mammals. There's a photograph of Harry as a six-year-old, wearing shorts and a t-shirt, knobbly-kneed, with a lopsided smile and sticky-out ears. His blonde hair is roughed up like he's just come in from running around or riding a bike outside with his sister Helene. It was around the time of this photograph that a second skeleton began to grow around Harry's first skeleton. This bone, too, was ordinary bone. But it was heterotopic, in another place, the wrong place. The only time in our lives that ossification, the transformation of cartilage into bone, should occur is when we're inside the womb. No new bones are supposed to grow once a person is born. They're supposed to be whole then. But it was as if the second skeleton of Harry's was working to shelter the first, as if the first was too fragile to continue going along on its own. If Harry hurt himself, if he broke his leg or stubbed his toe, his body repaired itself by growing bone in the place where he had been hurt. It took a few days or weeks for the bone to appear. The only way his body knew how to heal was to harden, so afraid it seemed of leaving any part of him vulnerable. There are four further photographs of Harry, all of them medical photographs, taken in front of a blank wall. And in all of them, Harry is in his underwear so that the form of his body can be clearly documented. At 9 years old, he is still smiling, and he seems braced in position by choice. His slightly crooked stance makes him look mischievous, like any nine-year-old. This is the last photograph in which he is able to raise his head to look directly at the camera. At 11, 13, and 20, he is curved. Something seems to ripple in bigger waves under his skin. His eyes are lowered to his hands, as if he is concentrating on getting himself out of handcuffs. As stark as these photographs are, they also show grace. Harry looks poised, as if about to raise his arms above his head and pirouette. His head and torso curve to the left, a delicate bow. Even as he is racked and pushed about by his new skeleton, he flows. Whenever Harry's physicians cut the new skeleton away, it would grow back forcefully over the next few months, as if in a panic. Soon it bound him tightly. Bone covered his back like a cracking cocoon. It welded his upper arms to his breastbone so that his arms hovered magician-like in front of his body. Bone wrapped itself in layers around his skull. Delicate columns of bone, like stalactites, fused his head to his neck, forcing him to stare at the ground. One of his legs was bent back, as if he were forever about to kick a ball, as if all the world were waiting in a grandstand around him. He could still move about by shuffling along with a cane. But when he was 20, when his mother could no longer care for him, he went to live at a nursing home in Philadelphia called the Philadelphia Home for Incurables. In his 30s, ossification reached Harry's lower jaw, which became locked to his skull, leaving him unable to speak. He couldn't brush his teeth, cough, stick out his tongue, lick an envelope or his own lips, whistle or eat. He lay in bed at the home, a diagram of himself, as if his second skeleton wanted to fuse him to a single spot and keep him safe there. He should never move haphazardly through the world like others did. It was 6 days before his 40th birthday that Harry died. His physicians took his body, as Harry himself had wished. Bequeathing it to science would give meaning and depth to medical and scientific research on FOP for decades. Following on from the few photographs of Harry as a boy and a young man, there are many, many photographs from all angles and proximities, depicting only his skeleton. He stands today in the Mutter Museum of the College of Physicians in Philadelphia, the city in which he was born. He's not far from the plaster death cast of Chang and Eng, the conjoined twin brothers who died in 1874, aged 62. In life, a 7-inch-long ligament joined them at the chest. The liver they shared is displayed beside them in a glass jar, preserved in formalin. Harry is alone inside a glass case. He stands on one leg, as he stood in life, his other leg bent behind him. He was easy to put together. Ordinary human skeletons require fine wires and glue for articulation, the gentle drawing upward of the bones, so that they hold together and stand tall. Without the wires and glue, they tumble into a pile. Harry's skeleton stood tall without help because the plates, sheets, ribbons, and thorns of his second skeleton fused him almost completely into one piece. You wouldn't know Harry's face or his handwriting or the sound of his voice. But even though he is faceless and silent, left alone, he is self-supporting and strong. We can look on the contained explosion of his skeleton, the way it seems forever breaking but never broken. Physicians, scientists, and students return and return to it. They say he is their sphinx. Harry's sister, Helene, comes each year to see him too, and to pay her respects. Witches. Each of us begins in the nude. It's true. In most of those early photographs, we are naked, wandering around the neighbor's backyard with a bucket, sitting in a river looking up, waving through an open window. It seems expected of us to be in the nude. Our legs are bandy and soft. Our arms are rolls of fat. Our face doesn't yet belong to us. All we really own are our eyes. We are greedy with them. We look and look, gobbling up our parents and brothers and pets with our eyes, looking at everything but ourselves. The self is a place where things are got: food, touch, sleep. And our conviction is that the world exists to give us things. We call that world into being each time we open our eyes. We laugh now about how unself-conscious we were then, how easy it was to be in the nude. There are photographs of us running naked, hands bunched as we tilt forward, amazed. We don't remember being amazed. We don't remember arriving in a doorway naked and glaring up at a taller person who must have raised a camera to her face. At some point in memory, days begin to grow out of fragments. The days sharpen and become facts. Always this point is during summer at the sea, when our hunger rose up cleanly inside our stomach, like a rock out of the water, and we weren't afraid to swim out to it. We ate and ate. "It's the sea air," said our mother, stroking our arms and our brothers at the same time. Many arms stretched toward her. Our arms were long and thin and covered in soft blonde hair like thistledown. Our fingers seemed prehensile. Our arms and hands grew at a much faster rate than the rest of us, as if forever reaching out to be stroked. By the time we were 8 years old, our arms hung halfway down our legs. What became of our friend? We had one special friend who came with us on holidays, she and her older sister. We sat with our friend on the banks of the lagoon beside a mangled tree stump, which was our boat, or our horse for riding over crabs at low tide. Naked, we crouched on the beach and scooped the sand out of the lagoon bank. Using our shoulders and forearms, we
Sample complete. Ready to continue?